From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we look at how the coronavirus is impacting the supply chain for businesses locally and internationally. Then, preparations are underway for the 2020 DNC in Milwaukee, and if history is any lesson, it could help Democrats win Wisconsin.
In a state as close as Wisconsin or a state as close as North Carolina, it might be enough to tip the balance in favor of the Democrats for hosting their convention in Milwaukee, and less so, but still a real possibility, tipping North Carolina against President Trump.
And Milwaukee's Hughes Family Band says their music style is the perfect fit for your favorite corner bar.
Milwaukee's it's a city of bars. There's some kind of romance about going to a dirty old bar, you know, smoky pool room, and listening to old country music and having a beer.
Lake Effect is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Across the globe and the U.S., governments and healthcare agencies are working to slow and stop the spread of COVID-19. This has not just impacted people's health, but their jobs and the health of our global market. Manufacturers are struggling to manage the pandemic's growing impact on their supply chains, as factories and plants have shut down or significantly reduced their production, particularly in China. Many companies rely on China as a single-source supplier in order to secure parts or keep costs low. However, it's at times like these where supply chain's lack of resiliency is clear. So what can companies do to strategize and get past the coronavirus's impact without heavy losses? To help us understand, Martin Staples joins me in the studio. He's worked in supply chain operations for Emerson Electric in Racine for 25 years, overseeing international operations, and is now a consultant. He begins by explaining the basics of supply chain.
Companies make and sell products. Well, in order to do that, if they're a physical business, they've actually got to buy materials, which is part of the supply chain. So where do they get the materials in order to put them together to sell you, whatever it might be, your iPhone or Harley-Davidson motorcycle, whatever it could be? Parts come from around the world at different locations.
So when it comes to supply chain, is this an integrated part of a business's strategy, cost, you know, risk,
definitely,
all of that?
Yeah, material usually makes up, and it'll vary, but it'll be from 60% to almost 80%, depending on the industry. So a significant portion of it, and so they spend a lot of time planning on that. General process is, you know, on an annual basis, we'll kind of look and say, okay, what are we going to sell? They kind of lay out how much of material they're going to need. And then monthly, they're going to set up like a 12-month rolling forecast and say, this is our demand, you know, the whole supply and demand. So if we got that much demand and we've got to sell, we got to buy this much material. So they'll start planning month by month where it is, and they'll update that every month. So generally people are looking 12 months ahead trying to plan because lead times can be pretty long. They're not necessarily that short.
So as the COVID-19 virus continues to impact China, what do basic operations in China look like for American companies? You used to work for 25 years for Emerson Electric here in Racine. So what was your experience there, just to localize it?
Right. So my experience with Emerson, I actually had, at one point before working for InSinkErator, I had factories in China and I had suppliers in China. So I spent a lot of time there. China as a manufacturing location is kind of interesting because the factories are, they range the whole spectrum. You can have highly manual operations with tons of people, you know, and then you have highly automated ones, you know, which are even more competitive. How can I say this? They're more automated than the some of the factories we have here in the U.S., a lot of capital there. What's interesting is that almost everywhere in China, though, there's a ton of people in the manufacturing process. And for the manufacturers, there's a large migrated population. About 100 million moved from the inner parts of China over to the coastal cities where all the factories are. And so with this coronavirus, that's a bit of an issue for these people to travel around.
So in your experience traveling there with Emerson Electric, was it a mix of a lot of people involved in the manufacturing process and a lot of automated? What was the basic makeup for that?
Yeah, so generally companies will do, and this is almost any company, but when you go to a low-cost manufacturer, you basically say, what's the cost of capital versus the cost of labor? So if my wages are low, I can actually use more labor than capital. If I'm getting into higher wages, all of a sudden I have to start investing in more automation and more capital to do that. China has actually been having increased wages, and so people have been investing more and more into the capital side. And this does vary by industry. If you look at electronics, it's highly automated because it's very precise and very detailed. And other some of the low-tech industries, such as machining and all that, some of that can be very manual. I've seen people just doing things on hand lathes with no safety equipment. So it really runs a gambit.
Your current consulting business helps with companies dealing with this problem right now. So everything from electronics to clothing companies. So in your role right now, what are you seeing with the impact of the coronavirus and how you're trying to help these companies either strategize to last or strategize to hopefully not have too much loss?
Right. And it's a tough thing. Right now, there's a lot of unknown out there. So the best example is the one where I'm dealing with the electronics. And the majority of the electronics, or at least electronics components, come out of China. So we were actually caught because the Chinese New Year, which is usually a couple weeks shut down, and then China extended that. So there's a critical component we need that we are unable to get. So pretty much everything was on hold for a month. So it wasn't until they came back from that that we could actually get that on order. So that put a big hole in the whole supply chain. So if you plan out months in advance, you get this ongoing stream of materials coming in. Now you got a hole that's not there, and that's a problem. And it wasn't just that period that China was shut down. They basically shut down the whole economy. But now that they're coming back, even the shipping is, the transportation's not there. Because as one of the things that people did was to stop the commercial flights into and out of China. Well, a good portion of air freight actually goes on commercial flights. So the lighter things like electronics, a lot of that flies on commercial airlines. And now that, even though it's made over in China, we can't get it over into the U.S. So it's extended way beyond where we thought it was going to be. So we're still struggling. And we're quoting some additional suppliers here in the U.S. who would be assembling. They need components from China, and their lead time to quote for us is like out of 18 weeks. And that takes me into July. So I have a big hole in my whole supply chain right now we're trying to sort through. So we're looking at alternative suppliers. We have different supply chain routes, seeing what we can do to find, you know, a strategy of a short-term fix, which may be a higher cost, and look at a lower-cost long-term solution.
With short-term higher cost, even though the labeling is short-term, there is no quite short turnaround in this business, though, correct?
That's correct. So there are some stocks of components out there in different areas, but now I'd say the strategy that people are doing is trying to buy things and get it into their warehouse as opposed to leaving it in a distributor's warehouse. So it's a bit like hoarding. When there's something going on, everyone wants bread.
Or toilet paper or hand sanitizer.
Or mask, whatever it could be. You call your thing. The same thing's going on in the industry. People say, well, it's better to be in my inventory than in my distributor. So if you're willing to pay the price, people are jacking up the price. And so you could pay a premium to get something into your house or into your warehouse for the short term. It'll hold you over until you get to the long term.
And are those strategies pretty much the same, whether it's on a local or national level?
Well, it's interesting. I would say yes. Most companies should be out there right now, and hopefully they've already done this. If not, they need to start doing that, is start to evaluate their supply chain and understand, okay, are my suppliers in China? What's the risk? Is there something in a distributor? Even contact your distributors and say, how much do you have on the shelf? You know, is there some that I can bring in or whatever it might be? And then go to your suppliers, you know, who are here locally and ask, how many parts do they buy from China? So you need to start to evaluate that. And companies are doing that, you know, locally or internationally. You know, a more international one will be reaching out to China. A local one should also be reaching their suppliers and making sure that their supply chain isn't at risk. I think those are the major strategies, you know, trying to do what you can and just keeping in contact with your suppliers is really key, because then you're known. As long as you're touching base with them, if it really comes, you know, to a tough situation, the more they know you, the better they're going to serve you. So that's also
helpful.
Does
the same follow for customers? Are companies trying to have open communication and saying, like, hey, you might notice XYZ, this is why?
They are. You're trying to be proactive. You know, no one likes to have surprises, and that's always an issue. So the upfront communication you can do with, you know, your customer and say, we're seeing these longer lead times. Be aware, we're going to do everything we can to serve you, but be aware that this is coming. I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing the stuff in the stock market. People are starting to see this kind of ripple through.
With supply input for companies, there's also the effect of the consumer market, right? So
Correct. People,
there's not as much things to buy. Also, China's market is consumers.
Correct.
They're also having a drastically different pace with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think this started out initially with China as a supply chain issue, but it's turned into a demand issue. Definitely in China, where everything's shut down. We talk to people and no one's out in the street over there. You know, they're staying in, they're ordering food at home, et cetera. And we can already see this in places like Italy and even in the U.S., things have started to be canceled, South by Southwest and some other events. That's going to be a drop in demand. So it's probably going to be, you know, we call it a bullwhip where you got this spikes in demand and then drops in demand. So what you can see is going to happen is there's going to be a drop in demand, so suppliers will start to order less, and then all of a sudden there's going to be a peak in demand, and now the suppliers can't catch up again, and sometimes the supply chain shrinks when there's these kind of drops. I've already heard of some situations where some suppliers are struggling. If they go out of business, when the demand comes back, now it's tight, and then it becomes more of a crisis again.
Right. And right now, there's the immediate cash flow problems for companies in the short term or long term. We don't know how long this could extend.
So
has there been any precedent of the government or even local state government giving breaks or incentives so that the impact isn't felt as deeply in situations like these? Because it's not a matter of failing as a business because your business plan wasn't
resilient.
You know, this is a global impact that no one can anticipate.
Right. I'm not an expert in that area, but I believe that there were steps taken back in 2008, 2009 to add some liquidity in the market to help companies out during that time. And some of the stimulus that they're talking about doing of, you know, cutting payroll taxes and other things can help out for workers and so forth. So those things will be very helpful. But, yeah, a lot of companies, I'm trying to remember, I think that there were some big initiatives taken back in 2008, 2009 with the auto workers specifically because they were concerned that as demand dropped, a lot of the automobile supply chain would be shut down. And so they want to make sure they were there to be available when they came back and they could respond.
Do you recall what Emerson Electric was doing around that time, or was it kind of hit and miss?
I lived through that. It was tough. I started here in 2008 in St. Louis at a company, and then I was over in 2009 in Slovakia running a company. So I had a chance to see both sides of it, and it was a global impact. So we reduced the workforce quite a bit, actually. And I remember in my factory in Slovakia that time, we actually went to the workers and negotiated that everyone took a 10% reduction in wages so we didn't impact the workforce. So, you know, it's time to be creative, you know, because you kind of need to figure out how can you do it because you want to have the workforce there and you also need to have the capacity there. So I would say Emerson, a lot of companies, what they'll do is during a downturn, you want to actually try and improve your process because you want to get stronger. So you try and do any restructuring you can and get yourself in a better situation so when it comes back, you're more efficient.
Do you think this could plunge the global economy into a recession?
Those are the reports I've seen.
Right.
I'm not an economist, but what I've been reading is that it could be. And
or do you see the similar kind of patterns that is only a matter of time until things?
Yeah, it's hard to say. And again, it's my opinion, but I was reading The Economist, and they had a really interesting report. I think it was from the World Health Organization. The World Bank. And they were showing the impact on the GDP globally and by region, depending on how severe the crisis gets, if it's mild or if it's severe. And if it was severe, it was going to have a significant impact on the global economy. I thought it was down like 4% globally for a severe outbreak.
Yeah, because it's hard when people's minds go automatically to that when they see the stock market pause for a day or plummet. But when there's a widespread panic, I imagine, do businesses look at it the same or do they have a known relationship of like, well, this is what is being reported, but we'll deal with things as we feel them or adjust.
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone, again, companies tend to do this monthly review of their demand. So they're looking and they're talking to their sales force. They're trying to get feelers as to what's going on. And I would say a lot of companies in the supply chain right now are kind of nervous, you know, and the customers, you know. It's kind of an unknown. How bad will it be? So I don't think a lot of people are making a lot of long-term bets on their purchases for materials. So I think they're going to be a little more hesitant as to what they're going to do. But so they do hear what's going on with the economy and what they hear in the news, but they're also listening to see what their customers are telling them at this point. You know, in the U.S. economy, what is it, 70% is consumer consumption or consumer buying? So any kind of consumer confidence drop as a result of this, or even just, you know, the social distancing that they talk about is going to have a big impact on consumption.
The past trade war between the U.S. and China already had people reevaluating their supply chains. Right. So do you think this just proves that we just need an overall more resilient supply chain? And what do you think that would look like?
So, you know, there's not a one model for a supply chain. We did a lot of analysis trying to figure out what is the best model for a supply chain. And again, this is generalized because it varies by industry. It depends on what you need. But if you have a short lead time to your customer and a lot of changes, you need to have a very localized supply chain. If you can have longer runs, higher volume, you can have a longer distance supply chain. But we found to be the best for, and this is a larger company. You know, Emerson at that time was like $25 billion in sales. And we were, my company was around $700 million or so. We balanced it so we had about 80% from a lower cost source, which could be Mexico or China. And we had at least 20% coming from a local source, which was a higher price but more responsive. And so having that kind of balance gives you the flexibility. So when there's an issue with your longer lead supply chain, which is lower cost, you can respond to the local one. And having multiple sources for larger volume components is very prudent.
So I don't know how to define short term, I suppose. What do you think are the key things companies should be keeping in mind right now?
So if I was a company, and what I'm telling my clients to do is, we need to make sure we're talking to our suppliers, evaluate the risk to our supply chain. You know, do they buy directly from China, or do they know of any risk to their supply chain from China, and in this fact, even Italy at this point, and just see what it is, assess the risk. If you have some long purchase orders, which might be a, what we call a blanket order for 9-month volume, bring in a little more than you normally would, you know, so raise up to 30, 60 days of inventory on those parts. And just keep the relationship with the suppliers. You want to keep in touch so that you're getting first pass when things go bad.
All right. Well, Martin Staples, thank you so much for joining us and helping us break this down a little bit. We'll see what happens.
Thank you, Audrey. It's been a pleasure.
Martin Staples worked in supply chain operations for Emerson Electric in Racine for 25 years and currently is the president of Staples Consulting. You can find more stories about the coronavirus and its impact at WUWM.com. After a break, a researcher talks about how hosting the DNC in Milwaukee could sway voters here and across the state. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Democratic presidential nominations may still be up in the air, but preparations for the party's 2020 nominating convention are very much underway here in Milwaukee. Thousands of Democratic Party officials will gather in July to decide who will face off against President Donald Trump in November. Milwaukee was chosen to host the DNC over three other finalist cities 2 years ago. Now that the first votes have been cast in the nominating process, we're going to re-examine some of the reasons why Milwaukee might have been chosen to host the convention. Christopher B. Mann co-authored the paper, Where Do Campaigns Matter? The Impact of National Party Convention Location. It appeared in the Journal of Politics in 2014. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida, who started by asking why Milwaukee is a logical choice for the 2020 DNC.
Milwaukee does make sense. Wisconsin is an important state, and the research that my colleagues and I did found that when the DNC hosts their convention, in that media market, we would expect a positive effect for the DNC, as long as that media market in general terms leans towards the Democrats, and the Milwaukee media market certainly does that. So while there might be other sites that you could argue might also be good choices, Milwaukee is certainly a very sensible choice from a tactical point of view if the Democrats want to cash in on this historical pattern. Of course, historical pattern is no guarantee, but probably the logic behind the choice of Milwaukee.
Sure. But, I mean, there's a lot of cities that skew Democratic, but, you know, people were somewhat surprised. I mean, I wouldn't say entirely surprised, but somewhat surprised that Wisconsin turned red in 2016 or went so kind of overwhelmingly red. So even though Milwaukee and the media market that makes up this, you know, southeast corner of Wisconsin is certainly, you know, pretty Democratic, it does it have an effect on how things go statewide?
One of the important things about our research is that we're looking at the media market and not the whole state. So earlier research had looked at the state and found little, if any, evidence that hosting a convention was moving statewide numbers. But most conventions are held in big cities and big states. And so they're, you know, a local effect wouldn't necessarily be seen statewide. And what we see is an effect that will be on the order of a couple of percentage points from Milwaukee in the Milwaukee media market. That will be even less when it's sort of spread across the statewide totals, all the places in Wisconsin that are not part of the Milwaukee media market. It's an opportunity to maybe take advantage and get this boost in a state that is close, has been close in presidential elections and close in lots of other elections. And, you know, every advantage is something that, that the parties seek. And so it makes sense from that point of view.
Sure. And in that regard, the size of the media market, because you're studying media markets, makes sense here. I mean, I think of the 2016 DNC, which happened in Philadelphia, and Pennsylvania has a few different media markets that are heavily Democratic, but here in Wisconsin, there's pretty much just this really big one around Milwaukee, another one kind of by Madison, but they're kind of close by. So it seems like the balance is there, whereas in other states, the Democratic representation is a little bit more of a patchwork.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Democrats picked Philadelphia. It's the largest media market in Pennsylvania for 2016. They picked Milwaukee, which is the largest media market, as well as the most Democratic-friendly media market in terms of past voting history. And when you compare Milwaukee to some other cities, the media market as a share of Wisconsin is bigger than we see in other states, right? Philadelphia, while it's the largest, is not as disproportionately large because you have Pittsburgh and a variety of other sort of small and medium-sized markets in Pennsylvania. And you could go through a number of other swing states, right? Your neighbors across Lake Michigan and to the north and the UP, right? Michigan has many more media markets. It's harder to have as big a share as you would potentially capitalize this benefit in Wisconsin by coming to Milwaukee.
Sure. And they're also farther apart there, whereas here it's kind of concentrated.
Yes.
So I'm also curious, I mean, you researched the effect that Democratic conventions have and Republican conventions, and for some reason, the Republican conventions don't have the same effect as the Democratic conventions. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, they're not wildly different effects. What we see is primarily an effect on persuasion, and we see both a, you know, positive effect in places that lean towards the party hosting the convention and a backlash effect in areas that already lean against the convention. What's really striking about the Democrats is this is a much steeper difference. The Democrats get bigger benefits where they get benefits, and they get bigger backlash where they get backlash. But what this adds up to, when you think about cities, is that most city centers are very strongly Democratic, and the suburbs tend to move into swing areas, and the large proportion of the big urban area media markets are leaning Democratic. That's part of why Democrats get a big boost. What we don't know is why this sort of, it's a much steeper line, if you will, where Democrats get a stronger benefit and a stronger backlash than the Republicans do. That may be the nature of the party. It may be way in which nominees resonate or something about the way the parties present themselves at the convention. We've certainly been curious about that and thought about it a little bit, but we didn't identify anything that we could confidently say was a pattern that defines why the Democratic convention has this stronger local effect than the Republican convention.
Sure. And when you say that there's an inverse effect for the party voting against the one that is hosting the convention with regards to Wisconsin, I mean, following your theory, would you then say that we can predict in some senses a smaller Republican voter turnout in Wisconsin come November?
So we tried to separate the phenomenon of turnout, that is mobilizing people who might not otherwise vote, versus persuading people who were deciding between the two parties. And so what we would expect to see here is that in the red counties within the Milwaukee media market, they'll be a little bit redder. The blue counties will be a little bit bluer. And the net effect of that, because Milwaukee is so much larger, when you add this up in cumulatively across the media market of Milwaukee as the host city, that should advantage the Democrats because they get a boost of several percentage points in those, you know, from those Democrats in the area. And they, the trade-off is they lose, you know, some more people in other areas that might be leaning Republican, shifting towards Republican. But the net is a blue boost when you add up everything in the entire media market.
Sure. So it's a matter of density and the kind of rule of thumb that more dense areas, urban areas, tend to skew more Democratic.
Yeah. When you add things up, that is why it comes out to be a net benefit to the Democrats. In Milwaukee, you're obviously much more interested in the Democratic convention. But if you were hosting the Republican convention, right, it would almost be dangerous. The effects are weaker for that Republican convention, but there would be more support from Republican-leaning areas for Republicans, but there would also be more votes for Democrats. And because there are so many more Democrats, hosting the Republican convention is actually, according to the historical pattern, to the Democrats' advantage. If I were having a conversation with your colleagues down in Charlotte, North Carolina, we would be talking about the risk to the Republicans of increasing the Democratic vote share in Charlotte. That is a larger, you know, cumulative increase than any benefit they get from increasing Republicans in the suburban and rural areas around Charlotte that are part of the Charlotte media market.
Yeah, and that's really fascinating because, I mean, conventions are huge events. I mean, here in Milwaukee, it's not an exception. I mean, conventions for a long time have been held in sports stadiums, convention centers. You need tons of hotels. You need tons of infrastructure. And places that have this kind of infrastructure tend to be blue.
They tend to be blue in those big cities. And you know, one of the mechanisms that my colleagues and I who did this research point to is exactly all this attention, the local media attention, the word of mouth, the way it changes the sort of civic excitement about what's going on to host a big convention like this. That's different than holding a trade show because there's the national media attention and the spotlight on Milwaukee, where Milwaukee wants to show off. It's a huge civic opportunity to be in the spotlight like this, where all the major news networks will be there and they'll be covering it, showing the beautiful lakefront in Milwaukee and all the other great things that are going on as part of their coverage. So, it's a tremendous opportunity. What my colleagues and I have said is that if you are the Republicans, because of this risk, they're almost better off holding their convention in a state that's either safely red or safely blue, where it's not likely to tip the balance statewide for the Electoral College. States like Wisconsin or North Carolina, where they're hosting the Republicans are hosting their convention, right? There's a risk in doing it there. Whereas if you did it in a state that wasn't sort of in play, that local effect might not be enough. We're not talking about huge effect, but in a state as close as Wisconsin or a state as close as North Carolina, it might be enough to tip the balance in favor of the Democrats for hosting their convention in Milwaukee. And less so, but still a real possibility, tipping North Carolina against President Trump because of what happens in the Charlotte media market.
And the kind of diversity of it. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WWM 89.7 FM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and we're talking with Christopher Mann. He co-wrote the paper, Where Do Campaigns Matter? The Impact on National Party Convention Location, which appeared in the Journal of Politics in 2014. We're talking a little bit about how conventions affect the local voting dynamics. And I'm curious, do you think or do you know that the party leadership, whether it be the Democrats, the Republicans, or any of the other parties, behind closed doors, do they make the kinds of considerations that we're talking about? I mean, how actively do they consider where to place their conventions?
Before we did this research, you know, they certainly considered it in general terms. We looked at what they had said publicly and looked at, you know, historical documents about the presidential nomination process and debates about where to put the convention. It's pretty clear that people were thinking about this as an opportunity to highlight and impact those states and thinking about it. You know, since we wrote this article, my colleagues and I have had conversations with various party officials that suggest that they were aware of it going into 2016. You know, I don't want to claim too much of an impact, but I think the conversation continues that they can have an impact, that this does matter to each of the parties and their prospects for the presidential nominee.
Right. And I mean, all of the think pieces that came out of 2016, all of the kind of post-mortem analysis that came out seemed to have pointed out to dropping the ball on Michigan and Wisconsin in particular.
Yeah, it's unsurprising to see Wisconsin, right? For the Democrats, there's a lot of talk about the path back through the industrial Midwest. And Wisconsin is right at the front of that list. So it's unsurprising that that was the region that Democrats wanted to go to make their case to the voters, right? There's a lot of symbolism about being there beyond that local effect. We point out in our research, you know, that there's a longstanding pattern that the conventions provide a boost to each of the nominees as they occur, and that's as people tune in and what they see. But I'm sure we can expect the Democrats to highlight a lot of the kinds of themes that are important to voters in the Midwest, because in order to assemble an electoral college coalition, the backdrop of being in Milwaukee and what it means to be a major Midwestern city is going to be part of what they want to convey, not just to local voters, but to voters throughout the Midwest and throughout the country.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that Houston was a finalist to host the 2020 DNC, and a lot there seems to be this divide also among the Democratic Party as to whether or not you focus on the Midwest or do you focus on Latino and Black communities in the South, flipping Texas, for example. And it seems to be they've fallen on the kind of the forgotten man of the Midwest with this convention decision.
Yeah, and I think there was also some discussion of the fact that hosting the convention in Texas, right, if there is a bump from hosting the convention there that's felt at the local and state level, Texas is a big reach. You know, if it had been somewhere else in the Southwest, in Colorado, which is a very competitive state, or Arizona, which the Democrats are trying to make competitive, right, frankly, those cities might have been stronger contenders against Milwaukee with the argument of the path to the White House run through an electoral college strategy built around the Southwest as opposed to the Midwest. But right, for reasons that I don't claim any special insight into, but the case for the Midwest seems to have won out in that debate about where to host the convention, and thus it's in your fair city.
Well, it's really fascinating, your research, and I want to ask one last question. You know, given the fact that looking forward at elections, all we have to go on is historical data. So in your paper, you reference Florida. Florida in 2000. Everybody knows what happens in Florida in 2000. Pretty much decided the election that year. Do you think that changing where the convention location could have been that year could have determined the, you know, path of the last 20 years with regards to who's president?
You know, Florida is certainly a case that we pointed to where the election is close enough that one party or the other hosting their convention in Florida, the effects that we would expect from any of several major cities in Florida would be enough to tilt the balance. The problem with that claim is that, you know, just about anything could have tilted the balance in Florida. But, you know, it does give you the sense, and it's not out of the realm of possibility to project a state like Wisconsin being, you know, maybe not 500 votes, but a few thousand votes, where the net benefit of, say, you know, 7, 8, maybe 10,000 votes to the Democrats' advantage from hosting the convention in Milwaukee might be enough to make a difference in a razor-thin outcome. You have certainly seen outcomes that have been, right, approaching that level of closeness at the statewide level in Wisconsin. So it makes sense for the Democrats to go someplace where this might be enough to tip the balance, and where they want every single vote because they expect the state to be razor thin.
So these decisions are made in part on historical precedent and statistics, and in part alchemy.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is the art and the science, always.
Fascinating. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher Mann is a political scientist at Skidmore College. He spoke with LakeFX's Julian Haida. Coming up next, we have an in-studio performance from the Hughes Family Band. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues here on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Hughes Family Band falls under the country music category, but their background comes from heavy rock and punk, making for an interesting blend of grit and southern fried country. The Hughes Family Band like to call their sound bar boogie, and they shared some of it with us at a recent stop in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Here's their song, 100 Tears.
Well, she calls me up just to bring me down. Yeah, it gets her off. She's the baddest around. She don't take no shit. She only gives in. The scorched earth approach. No one can win. Sure can. So when I see you out at the show, you know I get that same feeling as you. I know you'll cry 100 tears before every night that I'm not there.
You know I can't get down.
Sure do. See you out at the show. You know I get that same feeling as you. I know you'll cry 100 tears for every
That was 100 Tears from the Hughes Family Band. They are here in studio with me right now. We have Ian Hughes on guitar, Connor Lemieux on bass, Bryce Kudrovich on drums, Nathan Hughes on keyboard, and Johanna Rose on backup vocals. Thank you all so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right.
So, you know, I've seen your style described in a number of different ways. Honky-tonk, southern fried country, which I had thought was just a food descriptor. But how do you explain your sound to the kind of uninitiated?
Just bar boogie, mostly. Just getting drunk, having some drinks with the lady, and dancing and playing country music, a little bit of rock and roll mix in there, and yeah, I don't know what else you'd want.
Yeah, so bar boogie is just kind of like the kind of music that you want to dance to in a bar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're at a old saloon, or you're at some just dive bar, and somebody's playing rock and roll or country, and you're like, hell yeah, all right, let's do it.
You know, you mentioned saloons inside of that, and to me, saloon says like old country. And when I listen to your music, I think of like old country songs, and it feels inspired by that kind of vibe. And I've seen a lot of Milwaukee bands that are cropping up with that kind of inspiration. What is it about that sound that really speaks to you?
Milwaukee's it's a city of bars. There's, you know, corner bar in every place. Everyone has their own little spot, and so maybe there's some kind of romance about going to a dirty old bar, you know, smoky pool room, and listening to old country music and having a beer with your friends, or
And that's like the atmosphere. And sometimes the content is maybe like, I cheated on my woman, or my woman done me wrong, or, you know, a combination of all the stuff where the bar is just where that's the only answer for
it. Yeah,
you.
It's the home.
Yep.
It's home base.
Yeah.
So your next song, Golden Light, can you tell us a bit about that?
I wanted to write a song that was kind of a gospel-esque song where, you know, it's this idea of the golden light, but then there's the double meaning that it's just about drinking beer. So it's kind of a gospel song with a lot of those kind of like hymnal type themes, but it's really just about drinking beer and kind of our experiences all living in River West and having fun together and the good times and the bad times.
All right, well, here is Golden Light from the Hughes Family Band.
You're itching for some kicks, but you ain't got no money. And you wanna stay up, see that warm sunshine. Stand on up, drinking from that cup. Cup of that simple golden light. Hard times will find up in the city. Do it wrong when you try to do right.
That was Golden Light from the Hughes Family Band. Thank you all so much. So you've been recording some new music recently. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, we've taken a couple trips to Madison to record what initially was just going to be, you know, a couple songs that, you know, developed into a full-length 10-song what'll be album. And it's been a lot of fun working with Kyle Motor, recording onto tape, which has been a new experience for some of us. But yeah, we've been having a blast with him. We work really well with him, and it's exciting to do a full length because it will be able to, you know, kind of better encompass who we are as a band and kind of show all of our different sounds together.
So the hope is that the album essentially sounds like you do when you perform a live show, but not doing exactly a live album.
Well, no. I mean, it's all of the bare bones were tracked live, so piano, guitar, bass, drums, all of that is
all the
tracked.
Lead vocals.
Yeah, we did like the four main components, and then we did vocals on top of it. And yeah, it's essentially like when it's all said and done, it will be what you see at a live show, like with the horns, and like when we can do the whole family.
The whole family.
Yeah.
Involved,
then yeah. That's the same thing.
That's the extended family.
Yeah, it's the extended family.
Well, and you have a new member of perhaps your unextended family, Johanna.
Oh, hi there.
Now, Johanna, how long have you been performing with the Hughes Family Band?
We did a extended family show, and that was the first time that I performed with them.
So you're about to head out on a small tour, pretty far south. What is it like performing music that I think a lot of us think of as traditionally Southern as a band from Wisconsin?
We're going to find out.
I don't know. Rock and roll is rock and roll, man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
If you like it, you like
it. Rock and roll never die.
Yeah, if you like it, you like it.
All right. So what do you have for us to take us out?
There's a song called Take Your Place. That'll be on the new record.
All righty. Well, thank you all of the Hughes Family Band, at least the unextended family, for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
I gotta find something to take your place. Head for whiskey or a police chase. I'm not saying that I'm down and out, but I feel like I'm stuck and floating around to find something to take your place. Cause I've been busting through state lines across golden fields and neon signs. Will I change your name and I change yours? I'm not coming back for you. You and me, well, we won't ever see you no eye to eye, so we can be a fine. Something to take your place. When I'm lonely, when I'm feeling blue, when I can't get my mind off of you. Hurts so bad and I miss your touch, but a fool in love is foolish enough to find something to take place. Cause I've been bleeding for some time, but I'm bandaged up and I'm doing fine. Well, change your name, I should change yours too. I'm not coming back for you. You and me, well, we won't ever see you no eye to eye, so we can be a fine. Something to take your place, it's coming soon. That you were by my side, telling me where I'm wrong and where you're right. Time will make it better, you see. You'll be alright, and I'll still be me. But I gotta find something to take your place. Can't find a woman to take your place. Cause I've been busting through state lines across golden fields and neon signs. Will I change your name and change yours too? I'm not coming back to you. You and me, we will never see you no eye to eye, so we can't be a fine something to take your place. You and me, we won't ever see you no eye to eye, so we can't be a fine something to take your place.
That was the Hughes Family Band in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. They spoke with Joy Powers, and you can catch them this Friday night at the Flat Out Friday official after party at the Cooperage in Milwaukee. We have time now to finish today's show with an essay from contributor Megan Schultz. Her writing often focuses on the experiences of motherhood, midlife, and aging. Her essay, Before It's Too Late, asks us, when do we actually remember getting old?
I look in the mirror this morning and see my grandmother. Or at the very least, I see her jowls, just below my own cheeks, though if I smile, you hardly notice. Immediately, I want to call her and ask her, before it's too late, when she remembers getting old. I mean, one day, she must have looked in the mirror and said to herself, I am an old woman. Right? Is that how it works? Or is it a slow and gradual shift? Is it that one day you wake and find a wrinkle where yesterday it had been smooth? And the next week you look again to find that pesky hair on your chin has grown back again? So you cover the wrinkle in cream and tilt your head under just the right light, and with your tweezers you pluck the hair. I want to ask my grandmother all these questions. When did you decide you were old, and how did you feel? Or is it not until now, on the cusp of your 90th year, when you can no longer see the hair sprouting from your chin or the lipstick that you've smeared above your lip line, that you decide to call yourself an old woman? Was there a day, a week, a year that you knew? And was it glorious or frightening? I should ask my mother, too, except she doesn't feel old to me. She's just my mother. Occasionally, she asks the same question twice, and I see the wrinkles in her hands, the ones my own hands are beginning to mimic. But somehow, before it's too late, seems a very long way off. Though, of course, we never know. We never know. I know you're only as old as you feel, and that age is just a number, and that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But I'm talking jowls here, people. The inevitability of jowls.
Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz is a mom and writer who lives on Milwaukee's East Side. You can hear her past contributions at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.